Welcome to No Limits. In this week for John Kroll, I'm Eric Bradner. Today we're going to talk about white-collar crime. We'll discuss what it is, how it's investigated, and how it's prosecuted. We'll examine public perceptions of white-collar criminals and the penalties that those perpetrators face. Our guests today are Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson, Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry, and his lead white-collar investigator, Tom Gancars. You can join the conversation by emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, connecting via Facebook or Twitter at No Limits, or calling 866-476-3881. Please stay with us.
Support for No Limits is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu.
Welcome to No Limits. I'm Eric Bradner, Statehouse Bureau Chief for the Evansville Courier and Press. Today we're talking about white-collar crime. Our guests today are Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson, Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry, and his lead white-collar investigator, Tom Gancars. And Tom, I want to start with you to just sort of explain to people what white-collar crime is. When does a theft, for example, become white-collar?
Well, thank you, Eric. Basically, what we're looking at when we talk about white-collar crime, that was a term coined back in the 1930s. And it basically dealt with those professional type people who use their expertise and knowledge within their particular field to basically steal, lie, and cheat either their employer or an innocent victim out of their money. Throughout the years, it started to cross anybody became involved in that type of crime where they felt that they had the motivation, the opportunity, and the rationalization that they had the ability to make money without using a gun, basically. The frauds range everywhere from mortgage fraud, which is pretty prevalent nowadays with all the foreclosures taking place. We're looking at bankruptcy frauds, corporate frauds, securities frauds. And we've seen the case that the FBI had with Tim Durham. The things that we're finding out today is that it's affecting everybody. It no longer is limited to the people who have money. A lot of times the victims are those who, you know, are scammed or defrauded out of their life savings. You know, kind of the annual cost, I believe in 2010, was $20 to $90 billion annually was the losses that were.
And that's nationwide?
That's nationwide. I believe the National White Collar Crime Center did a study in 2010, and they were looking at 1 in 4 households were actually the victim of some type of fraud, whether it's identity fraud. We know a lot of the frauds take place through telemarketing, over the internet, the Nigerian scam letters, things like that, people are becoming victim of.
Now, Terry, there are obviously a lot of government agencies involved in investigating and prosecuting white-collar crime. What role does your office play? And obviously, you have a lot of violent criminals to prosecute, that sort of thing. How big is the white-collar crime division? What percentage of your duties does that take up?
Well, I guess I'd answer it this way. First of all, in terms of what role we play, yes, we pull together and in terms of working in conjunction with any number of agencies. We'll probably talk about certainly with Secretary Lawson's office in terms of securities fraud. We'll probably can talk a little bit about our relationship with workforce development, unemployment compensation fraud. But ultimately, we play the pivotal role in that we're obviously responsible for prosecuting these cases. Any crime that occurs or touches upon Marion County, it is our responsibility to do that. And in terms of being able to put a percentage on it, I don't think we could do that in terms of the amount of work. But certainly from day one, when we took office in January of 2011, we've made white-collar crime and sophisticated crime a priority, and for a threefold reason. Number one, as Tom's already indicated, it is a crime that has impact even beyond the immediate victims, and it's has significant ripple effects in any number of areas, as well as being devastating to those who are victimized by it. Secondly, and Tom is the one who could attest to this, that you know, in spite of the fact that these type of crimes are typically ones that are subject to federal prosecution, or can be, because the federal authorities frequently, the Justice Department exercises discretion in terms of the types of cases they take, and in particular dollar limit thresholds, that if a county prosecutor is not willing and doesn't have the expertise and motivation to prosecute those cases, individuals could go out and easily perpetrate six-figure crimes that would then fall through the crack. And quite honestly, I felt that's what was happening in prior years, and one of the reasons we made it a priority. And lastly, and this doesn't really have to do with the direct impact of the crime and prosecuting those sort of crimes, but for me, it was important that we make it a priority as well, is because to the extent that there are individuals who believe there's a double standard in the criminal justice system, that if you are going to be serious about street-level crime, then you better be serious about sophisticated white-collar crime. Because if you're not, and you don't send the message that this is just as important, then it feeds into the cynicism that someone have in the public about a double standard in the criminal justice system. So we have made it a priority from day one, and with the addition of Tom in our office recently, the good news and bad news is we're getting more cases than we can do, but we will do them. But we have, and we can talk about some of those in the course of the hour, but we have an enormous number of potential cases coming to our office every single day.
Sure, and Secretary Lawson, when people think of the Indiana Secretary of State's office, I think they know you're involved in elections. Mm-hmm. They know you're involved in business registration. But I don't think many people know that you're also involved in securities. Can you sort of explain what your role is there?
Sure. The Secretary of State has a unique role as it plays with in the securities industry, because we license the securities professionals, but we also, the investments that they sell are registered with our office, so someone could validate first the fact that someone who offers them an investment is licensed and the security that they're selling is registered and should be on the market to be, or can be on the market to be sold. But then we're also help as a law enforcement agency as well, and I'll explain that in a second. But I think the biggest responsibility that we feel like we have is educating Hoosiers about financial literacy and how to protect themselves from these security scams in the first place. And I think it's interesting, we've seen statistics that say that 41% of the adults in the United States will grade themselves a C, D, or F on financial literacy. And so we've got a long way to go to get everybody up to a grade A. But I will say that we've made a huge effort in that part, but also we can help prosecutors like Prosecutor Curry here, and we have worked with his office. But, you know, Marin County has maybe a few more resources than some of our smaller counties' prosecutors would have. So we have what we call the Prosecuting Assistance Unit, and we have attorneys there who are former law enforcement or deputy prosecutors, former deputy prosecutors, and we have an expertise in investigating these paper trails, white-collar crimes. And so if we get a complaint from a victim, or if we get a complaint that's turned over to us by a prosecutor, we can help them gather the information. The prosecutor then makes the decision about whether the crime or whether the case should actually be filed. But we also have the expertise in our office to help the prosecutor by being deputized, and we'll even assist that prosecutor all the way through the trial as well. So we play a big role in as it pertains to securities and white-collar crime.
Now, Terry, I'm looking at a list here of several white-collar criminals or alleged criminals that you all have prosecuted in recent weeks and months, And just a quick look, it looks like about a handful and a total of around $2 million worth of crimes. Can you quantify how many white-collar criminals your office has prosecuted, how that number might have changed over the past decade, the past few years? Is this an effort that wasn't being undertaken in the past that you all have placed more emphasis on?
Yeah, I certainly believe we placed more emphasis on it. And just to go back, I was a candidate in 2010, and I am not exaggerating when I say that I actually had business people, attorneys approach me in the course of the campaign and say, you know, would you have the ability or would you prosecute business crime or white-collar crime? And my response typically was I would laugh. And so, of course, you know, one background fact that you probably should understand is that when I was a deputy prosecutor in the office, that's exactly what I did. I was responsible for white-collar crime. So as a consequence, you know, in terms of a percentage amount from you know, where it was in prior years to now, I could not tell you that. I mean, I think indicative of the number of cases we do is that three of our deputy prosecutors actually were awarded an annual award from the Indiana chapter of the National Association of Professional Insurance Investigators, just because the three of them assisted in so many insurance fraud-related matters. I don't know exactly what the list you have in front of you there, but you know, clearly in the last, just in the last 6 to 12 months, some of the more significant cases, attorney named Stacy Sheedy, who stole $600,000 out of a trust and guardianship accounts. She pled guilty and is sentenced to the Department of Corrections for 8 years. David Reese, another attorney who stole approximately $400,000 out of estate, just recently had pled guilty and was sentenced. We just had a woman by the name of Sharon Armacost, and she had stolen almost $700,000 from a doctor's office where she was employed. And those are indicative of the type of cases that we're beginning to turn over on a regular basis. And yes, it involves ultimately millions and millions of dollars combined in these cases.
I think it's interesting that you were asked on the campaign trail about whether you would prosecute white-collar crimes. And Secretary Lawson, you were in the Indiana State Senate prior to becoming Secretary of State, so you dealt with a wide array of issues. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about people's attitudes about white-collar crime and white-collar criminals. Is this something that really catches the attention of the voting public? Is this something that people are aware of, that they care about as much as they do perhaps the types of crimes they hear about more often, the violent crimes?
I certainly believe they do, and I think the legislature listens. You know, just this past session, we championed what we termed the Durham Rule, House Bill 1179, because, you know, Tim Durham lived in Indiana, but his company, Fair Financial, was in Ohio, and the type of securities that he sold could only be sold to Ohio residents, thankfully for Hoosiers here. But what we found when we looked at our Indiana code was that we needed to put some protections in place so that the same type of security being sold here in Indiana wouldn't result in crimes against Hoosiers. And so House Bill 1179 was passed, and that same registration by qualification security that was sold in Ohio, if it's sold in Indiana today, it's subject to more scrutiny and more audit processes so that the investors will be more informed about the type of investment they're about to get into. So, yes, I think the legislature is responsive as a result. And we all know people who've been, you know, scammed, I think, because it's becoming more and more prevalent. You know, our moms and dads and families get these emails every day that are asking them to, you know, somebody got stuck in London and could you please send them $500? You know, we see these on a daily basis. Just recently, my husband and I both received an email the same morning that said that Walmart, Wallmart with two L's, had sent in our name electronic devices to different family members, and would we send them the money for that? And so, obviously, you know, we recognized it as a scam, but some people probably didn't.
Sure. Yeah, I think we all get those emails occasionally. And Tom, I've asked about the attitudes of the public about white-collar crime, but what about the people who commit white-collar crimes? Do they think they're justified?
A lot of them rationalize their behavior. You know, if you look at the employee of a company or an organization, even the case that we recently prosecuted, Karen Armacost, it's either they have personal issues or it's the environment. A lot of times what we find out is that the companies just don't have enough internal controls, enough auditing, accounting procedures to kind of check over people's work and what takes place within their organization.
We'll pick it up there when we get back. You're listening to No Limits. We're talking about white-collar crimes. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. We're talking about white-collar crime with Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson, Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry, and his lead white-collar investigator, Tom Gankars. You can join the conversation by emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, connecting on Facebook or Twitter at No Limits, or calling 866-476-3881. And Tom, before the break, I was asking you about the attitudes of people who commit white-collar crimes. You were sort of explaining that, unlike perhaps some other criminals, they sort of feel they might be justified. They feel that they can get away with these things because businesses don't have the ability to catch them.
Well, and I just don't want to focus on the businesses, but in the white-collar crime arena, a lot of times the people committing the crimes, they don't view themselves the same as, the street crime, where you're using a gun, a knife, where you're stealing a car. They believe that their crimes aren't hurting people in the physical sense that we think about. But in turn, their crimes are, what I'm seeing today is they're crushing a lot of families. The amount of money that a victim loses, we may look at it and say, well, they've only lost $4,000, but that might be a family's entire savings. And if they lose that amount of money, that's a concern that needs to be addressed. And I'm glad to see that Marion County and even the state agencies are really pursuing this. They're making it a priority. And they're realizing that, this is a crime that the victim, has to be kind of looked after and protected.
If I could just add briefly to what Tom said about the attitude of those who commit mm-hmm. these crimes, he indicated that they have a ability to rationalize that, and I agree with that 100%. When I was prosecuting these cases, the first few that I did, it was always the response of the suspect or the defendant was it was a mistake, it was a misunderstanding, and of course I was very, very skeptical, of course, of their explanation of it. But I genuinely came to believe that they did have this rationalization mechanism, and obviously ultimately they're lying to themselves just like they lied to their victims. But I think Tom's exactly right. They have this mindset that they didn't do anything wrong.
Okay. We have a call from Bob. Bob, I understand you want to ask about mortgage fraud. What's your question?
Yes. First of all, I just want to say good afternoon to all your guests, and I just want to say that you're all doing an excellent job, and I have to say, Mr. Curry, you're doing an extremely well job as a city prosecutor.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome. I'm curious to know about the, as far as concerning the mortgages. Now, I understand, and I'm pretty sure everybody else understands who holds a mortgage, about the servicer. They having to pay back money because of their practices or that they were doing that were illegal to the consumer who hold mortgages. And they pay back money and to those people. But my question is what about the mortgage investor that did not want to, make any kind of agreements with the person that held the mortgages that hold the mortgages, would they be held accountable because of the improper practices that they did, like, you know, intentionally keeping those, holding on to that real estate and end up selling it? Well, I guess I would say is allowing it to go on foreclosure so that they can benefit. I don't know if that question was clear enough. Is it clear?
Yeah, and I think so. That, you know, clearly there's a fine line in many of these areas, and in the sort of scenario you painted there, a fine line between what might be perhaps unscrupulous business practices, but does it cross over into the area of a crime? And ultimately, you know, I think the final determining factor would be, you know, what was the intent in the first place? If in fact there was some sort of implicit or explicit misrepresentation with the ultimate intent to enrich themselves, then arguably there's been a crime committed. But that area does involve a fine line, I think.
Okay.
I might add, Eric, if I could,
sure,
that the Secretary of State's office, and this was before, obviously, I took office, but they were involved in several multi-state jurisdictional activities and joined other states in some of these cases. And Indiana did benefit from going after some of these mortgage companies. You know, auction rate securities is what we were calling it at the time. But Indiana did join in those suits against those companies. And so we have received enforcement fines from some of these companies, and in fact we use some of that money as a restitution fund for some of the people who had been scammed in the first place.
So. Would that be a civil enforcement action then?
Yes.
As opposed to a criminal
mm-hmm.
prosecution?
Yes, it was. It was a civil court case.
Right. Sure, and how much, how significant is this?
Well, we haven't had a lot recently. Most of these cases took place around 2008, 2009, when, you know, it was after the economy turned really bad and people started looking at some of these companies. And so I don't know exactly for sure, but it was in the millions of dollars that Indiana received our portion of the fine dollars from these activities.
Sure. Okay. Well, let's talk about the complications of prosecuting white collar crimes, and I think I also want to ask about sort of the business world today and whether there are factors that sort of make it take a long time to untangle some of this stuff, if there are any reasons, and Tom, perhaps you can address this, that some folks can get away with $600,000, perhaps $700,000, without being noticed. Are there impediments that exist due to any sort of legal factors, any sort of just problems with running a business, any challenges that exist?
I think the first thing is that, you know, when we look at, these are two separate entities. If you look at the individual person who is, you know, scammed out of their money, or the business, a lot of times businesses are hesitant to seek criminal prosecution due to the fact that, you know, then they're concerned about the image of their business to their stakeholders. So it may not be reported. But what we're finding out in today's economy, with the amount of crime that's taking place on the white collar sector, there's a greater tendency to report these to the authorities. A lot of times they may go to one authority and not get the answer, but we're finding out that, you know, either at the state level, the local level, or even at the federal level, these cases are being looked at and they are being addressed. One of the big things is that a lot of times the individual, kind of stepping away from the business, is that they're not even aware that they were the victim. So a lot of these crimes go unreported. The difficulty comes about in investigating these cases. These schemes, I mean, these people understand the laws and regulations who are committing these crimes. So they're careful to kind of, as Mr. Curry said, there's that fine line where they stay close to the laws and regulations, but then they eventually step outside those boundaries and commit that fraudulent act. And the investigative part of that is rather intense. It takes a lot of time, a lot of resources in order to analyze the information that you get and piece that case together.
Yeah, if I could add something there as well, Eric, the in terms of the difficulty, some of the practical issues are that our police department is necessarily focused upon violent crime, drugs, gangs, the things that all impact our quality of life, and obviously that is an appropriate focus. And as a consequence, the our police department at local level, and there it's a great department, but doesn't tend to have the expertise to investigate sophisticated crime. And perhaps I should have explained at the outset that that's again why it's important that our office kind of step into that void a little bit, because over the years, going back to when I'm a deputy prosecutor until today, we have always had a handful of officers, investigators assigned to our office full time, and the purpose of that is to undertake these type of investigations, more long-term, sophisticated investigations. So we have four detectives from IMPD. We have two officers from the Sheriff's Department and a detective from the State Police who work at our office full-time. Tom is their supervisor. But that is a fundamental practical problem, and that is having the individuals who actually have the expertise to investigate this crime. That's why in Secretary Lawson's office, that is a great resource for other prosecutors' office to have the prosecuting unit there with the individuals who have that expertise as well.
One thing I might add is one reason I think that those types of crimes don't get reported is because oftentimes these folks prey on senior citizens. They know that the senior has been brought up to trust their family and their neighbors. It never was an issue for them. They know that the seniors have worked and have saved to have a good retirement. And they can prey on these seniors. And unfortunately, many of the seniors are embarrassed if they get caught in one of these types of situations. And they're really reluctant to report it. And so when I go out and talk to senior groups, I tell them, not to be embarrassed, because you're going to not only help yourself, but you'll help someone else in the future if you call and let us know that this is happening.
We're talking about white-collar crime today on No Limits. You can join the conversation by emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, connecting via Facebook or Twitter at No Limits, or calling 866-476-3881. I want to ask about penalties for white-collar crimes, too. Terry, maybe you can sort of explain what the penalties that exist are right now and whether you think they're fair rather relative to other types of crimes.
Typically, I guess the most obvious would be, let's talk about securities fraud to begin with, as it's under current law. The fundamental securities violations are C felonies, so that would involve a penalty of 2 to 8 years. Interestingly, and since Secretary Lawson just mentioned senior citizens, actually, if the victim is a senior citizen, it actually elevates that crime to a B felony. And just anecdotally, we actually have one of the cases we're working with Secretary Lawson's office right now involves a plea of guilty to the B felony because the individual victimized elderly members of his church.
About $580,000, I think.
That's correct. And actually, Mr. Redman is the defendant in that case, a former securities dealer, and he's awaiting sentencing in that case. To answer, I guess, your question, do I think that is a fair range? Yes, I believe so. One thing I guess we could build into it is that fundamental theft is a D felony, which is the least serious felony. And if it's over $100,000, it elevates it to a C, which is 2 to 8. As part of the code revision, which just occurred in the last comprehensive criminal code revision, just occurred in the most recent legislature, those categories are subject to being tweaked a little bit. But, I guess there's sort of a twofold answer to your question. Number one, what does the law provide? And then secondly, what do the courts impose? And not being critical of anyone in particular, but I, just following the news over the last several years, I was surprised how often I saw sentences that I thought were not appropriate, you know, given the level of, and I feel like that we've gotten a number of significant sentences for the individuals we've prosecuted here in the first 2.5 years in office, including, as I said, an attorney who's serving an 8-year sentence right now in the Department of Corrections. So we feel it's just as important that the court take it seriously and impose those sort of sentences so we can send the message to the community.
And Secretary Lawson, do you agree with that sentiment? Obviously, criminal sentencing reform has been a topic of conversation at the State House for several years mm-hmm. now. Is that something that needs to be looked at further, or have legislators made progress on that?
Well, you know, I can't really answer that, but I can just tell you that from the Secretary of State's office, the cases that we've been working, for an example, recently, we had a case in Franklin County, in Dearborn County, a guy by the name of Jason Snelling, and he was involved in bilking about $4 million from his co-defendants, families, and friends. They used that relationship from that family business in Franklin County to scam people in Franklin and Dearborn County. And he's actually been sentenced to 40 years in Franklin County and more time in Dearborn, and I think even more time in a federal court. So obviously it depends on the type of crime, the number of victims, and so forth. But we're also expecting a sentencing in Vigo County by another Jason Severs, who actually stole quite a bit of money as well. So he's pled guilty, and I believe we'll have that sentencing coming up in August. So he's likely to get anywhere from 10 to, I believe, maybe 25 years, minimum of 10, maximum of 25.
And Tom, as you've been investigating these white-collar crimes, have you observed that there are any particular types of white-collar crimes that make juries the angriest?
A lot of it has to do just with the defendant and the scheme that they use. Sometimes, you know, it is the complication, if it's presented in such a manner that, you know, it's pretty obvious that this is how the money was taken. You can see the jurors, you know, you read the jurors as they're hearing testimony, and you can see the reaction of disgust, and you know, they take it pretty serious, and I believe that they listen and they understand, and you know, I've seen since, you know, coming over here to Marion County, they really take this to heart and look at the victims and the defendant as far as what they've done to these people.
Do you think that they're open to considering the defendant's arguments, the motivations of the defendants, the reasons behind their grab for money, grab for...
I don't believe that. In my personal opinion, I don't believe that the jurors buy off on it. A lot of times, you know, we all struggle financially in the current economic times. We all have our personal issues, but that's not a license to go out and steal and cheat somebody out of their money.
Sure. We're talking about white-collar crimes today on No Limits. You can join the conversation by emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, connecting on Facebook or Twitter at No Limits, or calling 866-476-3881. Tom, I want to go back to the beginning of a white-collar investigation. I wondered if you could sort of quickly hit what triggers these investigations. Is it usually someone who works with the person, who knows the person? Is there a source for reporting that you see most often?
The majority of cases are usually referred to the office either through a friend of a victim or the victim themselves. They feel that they were unjustly scammed out of their money, their savings, whatever piece of property it was, and they report. A lot of times referrals come from other agencies. The thing that I'm really finding out that's
we'll have to pick it up back there when we get back. We're talking about white-collar crimes today on No Limits. Please stick with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm Eric Bradner, and today we're talking about white-collar crime. And Tom, when we left, you were explaining how most of these white-collar crime investigations start. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I wonder if you could pick up on what you were saying.
Yeah, and the final point I want to make is that what I'm really seeing in today is the sharing of information amongst all the various agencies at the state, local, and federal level. Agencies are bringing forward a lot of these issues, a lot of these problems, a lot of the crimes that take place, which makes it kind of easier for us to grab onto that case. And once you start digging into it, you find out kind of that spider web, how big it actually is. And that sharing of information amongst the various agencies has just been instrumental in bringing this to the forefront.
Yeah, if I could pick up on that, Eric, as well. We feel we've provided the impetus in that regard as to some of the state agencies. There's a long-standing relationship with the Secretary of State's Office and Securities Commission going back to another lifetime ago when I was a deputy prosecutor. So that working relationship has always been there and continues to be a great working relationship. But we have, for example, taken the initiative to work out an arrangement with workforce development to prosecute unemployment compensation fraud. And so we had some discussions with counsel there and worked out a working relationship where we devoted a deputy prosecutor full time to prosecuting those cases. And we announced that arrangement in February, and to date we filed 17 fraud cases just in the first few months. As part of that arrangement, also we have indicated that we will take on cases that in effect originate in other counties, but for one reason or another, the county prosecutor, just as Secretary Lawson was saying, perhaps some counties don't have the resources or ability to prosecute those cases. We're doing those cases as well because we can exercise jurisdiction to the extent that the claim ultimately is processed here in Marion County. And so we have two of those 17 cases we filed are actually from originating in other counties. We're talking with Revenue about the same sort of arrangement in terms of being more aggressive in prosecuting tax cases. We've worked with a number of agencies, including Indiana Department of Labor, to prosecute common wage violations. In a nutshell, common wage is a requirement that in public construction projects the employees be paid a certain wage scale that's set by a common wage council. We have prosecuted the first common wage case ever in the state of Indiana, got a conviction the first year. We have another one pending. We have more investigations going. So Tom's exactly right in terms of building upon those working relationships with federal agencies, state agencies. We just feel like things are going very, very well.
We have a question from William. William, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Long-time listener. First time caller, really appreciate it. Really appreciate everything they're doing, but why don't the investigators look at the Better Bureau Business website where, for years we've been placing complaints there thinking that someone's going to follow up on them? Is that just like putting a message in a bottle and throwing it in the ocean and, nothing's going to happen?
So the Better Business Bureau, is that a resource that you all lean on at all?
It's something that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, continue on.
No. For years, as consumers, we've been told, if this is a good business, go see what they're rating in the Better Business Bureau. And you'd find checkered paths of these companies for years, they're doing all sorts of malfeasance. And you'd hope that, from somewhere along the federal side or the state side, someone is following up on these complaints. And that was my question, and I will hang up.
I think Mr. Curry kind of touched upon that previously. A lot of times, a business may be engaged in a practice that, is unethical and doesn't, kind of meet the standards of what we expect of a business. Trying to determine if any criminality has taken place is a separate thing that has to be addressed. So you're kind of walking that fine line, is where does a criminality come in and where is it just a kind of a poor business practice?
Sure. one of the perhaps best known white collar investigations, prosecutions in recent years that's dominated headlines around here is the Tim Durham case. And I wondered if you all might be able to get into whether that's something that has led Indiana Marion County or anyone to sort of approach these issues differently. Has that led to any changes, or was that just one high-profile example of what you all deal with every day?
In my opinion, it would just be an additional example. I mean, I think there was obviously a significant amount of notoriety regarding that particular case. Number one, for obvious reasons, the amount of theft involved was significant, but in addition, just obviously the defendant's lifestyle and his associations, I think, turned that into more notoriety than the usual case. But in terms of the conduct, the patterns, no, those are exactly the sort of things that we see every single day, you know, not necessarily involving hundreds of millions of dollars, but millions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars, the same misuse of other folks' money. From the prosecutor's office, we see that every single day of the cases we look at.
And Connie, as you're helping counties deal with these situations, are you finding that they're encountering new ideas, new ways of scheming, of stealing money, or is it sort of the same thing popping up in a lot of different places?
I think it's pretty much the same pattern. You know, it's either a Ponzi scheme where, you know, they're taking investors' money, and then as they get new investors, they might pay the previous investors just a little bit to keep them on board, but they never have enough new investors in the end to pay off everybody, and so this, you know, the activity crumbles and people get caught. Or it might be affinity fraud. We see a lot of affinity fraud where people find a commonality among groups. It might be a religious group. That was pretty much the case of Thomas Redman, where he used his church affiliation to scam these senior citizens that Prosecutor Curry talked about. Or it could be like a minority group or a group of people who have immigrated here. So that affinity fraud is pretty common as well. We're seeing more oil and gas, you know, securities that are being sold, and that's kind of a commonality now that we're seeing as well. So we haven't seen anything brand new, but people use the same schemes to get people involved in investing, and it's unfortunate.
The oil and gas thing is interesting. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. We've got some cases going on, and usually what's happening here is that obviously they prey on people's fear that the gas prices are going to continue to rise, and you know they're not going to have enough fuel for their family and their transportation, so they're selling stocks or securities in oil wells. And the commonality is that, you know, they're spread out. So like the office might be in one state and the actual oil well might be in another state and the security is in another state. And so that it doesn't give an opportunity for somebody to really to check it out. And so they're, you know, somebody's going to invest in an oil that either doesn't exist or has been dry for a number of years. And so we're seeing those types of schemes, and we're investigating some right now. I will say the Secretary of State's office has been and worked with and gotten convictions in, I think, 36 counties so far. We think by the end of this year, according to the activity we've had, it'll be 40 by the time this year ends. And we're usually working on 40 to 50 cases at any one time. So, and that's just in our little bailiwick of security. So it's, I can't imagine what Prosecutor Curry sees on a weekly basis.
When you say 36, do you mean over the calendar year?
36 so far since we started our securities division in 2007. We've worked with and gotten prosecutions and convictions and sentencing in 36 counties, and we think it'll be 40 by the end of the year. And, of course, as things go along, we get better and we're more well-known, and we can educate the prosecutors what we have to offer them to assist them in investigating these types of crimes.
We have a question from David. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I guess my basic question is, is there an amount of lost money that matters whether the prosecutor gets involved? You talk about Tim Durham, hundreds of millions of dollars and then millions of dollars in singular amounts. I had a home contractor who bilked me out of a $7,200 check for granite, which I wrote him, which he cashed, which he never bought granite with. I took this to the prosecutor's office, and they said, oh, well, this is a civil matter. And I kept looking at the prosecutor's reception room saying, is there a sign that says the amount of lost money matters most? This is a contractor who has been had judgments against him previously, which he just skipped out on. The prosecutor's office doesn't seem to care about that. I'm in small claims court next month. As you know, that's a $6,000 limit that I can get back. He pockets $1,200 every time he does this, and he laughs at the system. Comment?
Well, David, thank you for the question. And Tom, perhaps we'll kick that one to you because it seems he's bringing up Terry, how about you? It seems he's got a couple of issues there. One,
well, first of all, is he still on the line? Is David still on the line?
David, you still with us?
Yes.
When was it that you came to the prosecutor's office?
Oh, 2 months ago.
Okay.
And the problem is that we have gone to civilian regular lawyers, and they say, well, you can put up, you know, lose another $5,000 chasing this guy, but you're never going to get your money. I mean, you're basically screwed. And there's something wrong with the system that the prosecutor's office says, oh, well, it's not enough money. You know, I mean, yeah, it's serial theft, but what the heck? It's only $1,200.
Yeah, well, first of all, to answer, I guess, your fundamental question, is there a dollar limit? No. You know, some of the cases we've prosecuted are exactly that sort of dollar amount involved. And I don't know exactly where you came, but you know, if, in fact, there were evidence that this person never intended to deliver the product, that is certainly something we could look at.
Why don't you
take this number? 327-1130.
Okay.
Leave the message, your name and number, and we'll get back to you.
Okay. Thank you, sir, very much.
You bet.
All right, we're helping people out today. We've got a question from a caller who didn't want to go on the air. And the question is multi-level marketing or pyramid schemes illegal? Tom, how about you?
It depends on, you know, what you're talking about. The pyramid scheme typically is almost like the Ponzi scheme.
What is a pyramid scheme, first of all?
You're building from defrauding one person, and then you're building that out, and you increase the amount of people that you're defrauding, and it just kind of builds to the top. So you have all these other people underneath you that are funneling money to the top, and that person is basically the one that's keeping the money and not passing it on as promised.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really hard question to answer in the abstract. I mean, because, for example, that terminology, multi-level marketing, would describe Amway, for example, or something like that, which is, not necessarily illegal at all. But on the other hand, if it's a classic sort of Ponzi scheme, as the Secretary Lawson has referred to, that's clearly securities violation and theft.
Okay. Let's talk about what's down the road. What issues in terms of dealing with white collar crime do you all foresee dealing with, either through the legislative arena or in terms of how you structure the prosecutor's office? Are there any new challenges you all are facing? Any issues that you foresee addressing in terms of how you go after this sort of thing in the coming weeks, months, years? Secretary Lawson, start with you.
Sure. Well, I mentioned that we educate Hoosiers, and I think that's one of the most important things that we as in the Secretary of State's office can do is educate Hoosiers of not only about financial literacy, but how to protect themselves from scams in the first place. So we go out and we do talk to people about what they need to look for, what the red flags are, like if the investor won't give you the prospectus in writing, that's a red flag. Will the investor, is he trying to force you into making a quick decision by saying, you know, this is a one-time deal, and you've got to make your decision by tomorrow? Pressuring somebody because of fear. We give them lots of red flags about what to look for, but we're also educating Hoosiers. I mean, it doesn't make any difference what walk of life, or if you're a student or an adult, we've got information to help you budgeting, you know, management, those kinds of things as well. And I think those kinds of things, at least from our perspective, help. But I would say that if anybody has any questions about whether or not an investment professional is licensed or whether or not the security is licensed, if they call 1-800-223-8791, that's important information for them, because they'll find out if the person who's selling the investment is legit and if the investment is registered.
Okay. From our office perspective, I think clearly the single biggest challenge is the convergence of increasingly sophisticated criminals versus the resources that we have on hand to do those investigations. Clearly, as technology becomes more and more a part of the crimes that we're looking at, you know, we need the expertise and the resources to be able to pursue those sort of criminals. It's no secret that countywide, you know, we're looking at budget issues, and so, you know, our challenge is, you know, how do we find the resources to pay that person who has the technological expertise to look at you know, computer, email, that sort of thing. How do we pay a forensic accountant, for example? And that's our biggest challenge at this point.
And really quickly, if someone has a problem that they want to report, Tom, what's the best way to do it?
The best way to do it is to contact Marion County Prosecutor's Office, you can ask for the Grand Jury Investigations Unit, ask to speak to an investigator. We'll take the information. A lot of times they'll ask if a police report's been filed. That kind of helps us move the case along, although a lot of times these cases are quite sophisticated and complex. They take a little time to investigate and unravel this scheme. And like Mr. Curry said, you know, what we're finding out is that the resources, the number of cases that we're bringing to the office, bringing to the prosecutor, are taking up a lot of resources.
All right. I'll have to leave it there. We've been talking about white-collar crime today on No Limits with Secretary of State Connie Lawson, Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry, and his lead white-collar investigator, Tom Gangars. I'm Eric Bradner with the Evansville Courier and Press. Thanks for listening.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alsett. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.